en el momento del homicidio. El jurado, compuesto por 12 personas blancas, en 10 minutos dio el veredicto de culpabilidad. En el año 2013 se solicitó un nuevo juicio para el caso de George Stinney, argumentando que fueron violados sus derechos porque en el proceso no participaron ni abogados ni testigos. El miércoles, la jueza Carmen Mullen, de Carolina del Sur, reconoció la inocencia del niño afroamericano. La Organización de Naciones Unidas para la Alimentación y la Agricultura, FAO, y el Programa Mundial de Alimentos, PMA, advirtieron que las repercusiones de la epidemia de ébola en los tres países más afectados de África Occidental pueden ser devastadores debido a que ya afrontan una situación de inseguridad alimentaria crónica.
A menos que mejore drásticamente el acceso a los alimentos y se tomen medidas para proteger la producción agrícola, el número de personas que pasarán hambre por culpa del virus en Guinea, Liberia y Sierra Leona podría superar el millón para marzo de 2015, aseguraron los dos organismos. En sus informes, las organizaciones explicaron que restricciones como el cierre de fronteras, las cuarentenas y las prohibiciones de caza ponen en peligro sus medios de subsistencia y agravan la escasez derivada de las pérdidas agrícolas en las zonas con más casos del virus. La pérdida de productividad y de ingresos familiares debido a las muertes por el ébola y el absentismo laboral por temor al contagio se suman a la desaceleración económica de los tres países. El subdirector general de la FAO y representante regional para África, Bukar Tijani, subrayó que es necesario que la FAO y sus asociados intervengan con urgencia para superar los trastornos que sufren la agricultura y el mercado porque podría producirse una crisis de seguridad alimentaria. Carlota Fluxá, Naciones Unidas, Nueva York.
Nos vamos a Noticias de México. Un día después de que un enfrentamiento en Michoacán dejara un saldo de 11 muertos, incluido el hijo de Hipólito Mora, ex líder de las autodefensas, el gobierno mexicano se deslindó del presunto responsable de la violencia. El comisionado para la Seguridad y el Desarrollo Integral de Michoacán, Alfredo Castillo Cervantes, afirmó que Antonio Torres González, alias El Americano, dejó de formar parte desde el 15 de septiembre de las fuerzas rurales coordinadas por el gobierno federal. Castillo dijo que Hipólito Mora sigue enlistado como policía rural. Señaló el representante del gobierno federal que ambos serán investigados para saber si dispararon armas de fuego durante el enfrentamiento en la tenencia Felipe Carrillo Puerto, conocido como La Ruana, municipio de Buenavista, Tomatlán. Castillo desmovilizó a las autodefensas formadas por ciudadanos que realizaban vigilancia en sus comunidades y a quienes aceptaron pasaron a formar parte de la llamada Fuerza Rural de Michoacán. Sin embargo, miembros de las ex-autodefensas han denunciado que la violencia no ha cesado en el estado y advirtieron que volverán a tomar las armas y conformar las policías comunitarias. Durante la agresión del martes en La Ruana, Hipólito Mora denunció en un programa de radio que su grupo estaba siendo agredido por las fuerzas del Americano, al que acusa de trabajar con el crimen organizado.
Y aquí están las consecuencias para Alfredo Castillo, que decía que todo estaba bien en Michoacán. Aquí les confirmo que nunca hablé con mentiras, que siempre hablé con la verdad. Un mensaje para los mexicanos: defiéndanse, luchen, peleen por sus derechos. No le crean a parte del gobierno, no le crean, engañan a la gente, no les importa lo que nos pase. Estamos a punto de que nos ataquen otra vez. Ya nos tienen cercados el Americano con todo el cártel. Nos van a matar. Les estoy contestando porque ahorita están los balazos calmados, pero están a punto de empezar, ya se organizaron, ya nos rodearon y las Fuerzas Armadas nos dejaron solos. Somos pocos, pero vamos a pelear hasta la muerte. Vamos a pelear como lo hicimos desde el 24 de febrero de 2013. Pura gente pobre que defendemos nuestros derechos, que nos enfadamos de ser pisoteados, de ser olvidados por el gobierno aquí del estado. Aquí está lo que siempre les dije. Pero nos vamos a morir con honor, como murieron los muchachos que están ya ahorita muertos, como los muchachos que murieron en el paso de este tiempo de que tomamos las armas. Vamos a morir con honor, no nos vamos a rajar, vamos a pelear con gusto por nuestra gente, vamos a morir a gusto por nuestra gente. Luchen, mexicanos, defiendan sus derechos, no se dejen pisotear. A algunos políticos solamente les interesa el dinero, el voto de los mexicanos, robar, hacerse ricos, aunque el país nos estemos muriendo de hambre. Tengo como 40 o 50 minutos o una hora pidiéndoles apoyo al gobierno y no llega nadie, nos tienen olvidados. La gente que nos masacró del americano, les ayudaron a subir los heridos y los dejaron que se fueran en vez de detenerlos. Y algunos de la fuerza rural de los libros se armaron, se llevaron las armas. Esta es la clase de gobierno que tenemos desgraciadamente los mexicanos. Luchen todos, saquen a Videles, saquen a los autodefensas, muévanse peleando, que les haga madre lo que está pasando, que les haga madre, que los maten, que les maten a sus hijos, pero defiéndanse. Mueren con dignidad, no sean cobardes mexicanos, alcen la cara, defiéndanse.
De norte a sur, de este a oeste, Enrique Peña Nieto no es mi presidente.
Un grupo de mexicanos en Estados Unidos demandó la renuncia del presidente Enrique Peña Nieto y denunció la violencia en el estado de Michoacán.
Ayotzinapa ha venido a colmar nuestra paciencia social. Su responsabilidad como directriz del Estado ha sido deficiente, ha sido lenta y falta de resultados en todos los ámbitos de su gobierno, por lo que exigimos su inmediata carta de renuncia y deposición del puesto del Poder Ejecutivo. El ataque a Hipólito Mora y su policía rural el martes 16 de diciembre del año en curso viene a reforzar nuestra acusación en contra de Alfredo Castillo y Enrique Peña Nieto. Esta petición será también presentada ante la Organización de las Naciones Unidas, en la Comisión Internacional de Derechos Humanos de la OEA y ante el presidente de Estados Unidos de Norteamérica, Barack Obama.
¿Dónde están los finos? ¿Están los asesinos?
Llevaron una carta al Consulado de México en San Bernardino, California, donde denunciaron las continuas masacres, desapariciones y la corrupción del Estado.
Nosotros, los ciudadanos mexicanos y de origen del Estado de Michoacán, demandamos la deposición del cargo del Poder Ejecutivo representado por usted, debido a la falta de compromiso social con el pueblo mexicano. Con anterioridad habíamos pedido su intervención para solucionar el conflicto de masacres, secuestros, extorsiones y desapariciones en contra de nuestras familias michoacanas, a lo cual no tuvimos respuesta positiva, dado que usted envió a un comisionado por la paz, el cual no solo no ha efectuado la labor asignada, sino que además se le ha vinculado con la corrupción institucional y el crimen organizado para seguir extrayendo recursos ilícitamente de nuestro estado de Michoacán. Los secuestros y asesinatos están a la orden del día. Familias inocentes están siendo asesinadas por los sicarios uniformados y protegidos por el esbirro Alfredo Castillo. Entre los policías rurales existen personas de diferentes rubros de trabajo digno y que pagan impuestos al Estado. Campesinos, obreros que se unieron con la esperanza de lograr la paz y la tranquilidad tan deseada en Michoacán, los cuales están siendo manipulados a conveniencia de intereses vanos, además que se les asignan misiones de alto riesgo y muchos de ellos están siendo emboscados, ya que no existe un plan de acción eficiente ni información de inteligencia anticipada para el combate a la delincuencia organizada. Siendo Alfredo Castillo el responsable directo de estas bajas y de no proporcionar los medios suficientes ni necesarios para ejecutar este tipo de operaciones.
En el documento denunciaron la persecución y encarcelamiento de líderes de las autodefensas.
Entendemos la importancia estratégica del puerto comercial de Lázaro Cárdenas y la falta de medidas regulatorias para impedir la importación de químicos como materia prima en la elaboración de estupefacientes y exportación de minerales extraídos ilegalmente. La privación de la libertad y encarcelamiento, falso de alineamientos jurídicos a José Manuel Mireles Valverde y la libertad condicional a Hipólito Mora, tiene un trasfondo más de intereses políticos que de alegato jurídico, ya que las acciones tomadas por ellos fueron consecuencia directa del falto Estado de Derecho del que usted como representante directo del Poder Ejecutivo se ha encargado de preservar. Es por demás injusto encarcelar a quienes buscan defender su derecho universal a la vida, protección de sus familias y patrimonios del crimen organizado como consecuencia del caso omiso por parte de las autoridades locales y federales.
Los mexicanos en el exterior pidieron la renuncia de Enrique Peña Nieto.
Las reformas estructurales que usted impulsó tan rápidamente y sin consulta popular únicamente apoyan al modelo neoliberal de privatización abierta a mercado, destruyendo así la autonomía del Estado y la constitución política mexicana.
Un representante del consulado mexicano se negó a comentar sobre la inacción del gobierno durante el ataque.
And este es todo para este programa. Welcome, however, to Free Radio Santa Cruz's Bathrob Spears Broadsides, which is coming up next on Free Radio. So stay tuned.
I've been living in Los Angeles, and I haven't been singing much for ever since Chicago. So if I don't remember the words, you've got to forgive me. I wrote these songs a while ago, when I was but a kid, walking through the American wilderness. Outside the window, there's a woman being grabbed. They dragged her to the bushes, and now she's being stabbed. Maybe we should call the cops and try to stop the pain. But Monopoly is so much fun, I'd hate to blow the game. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. The rats have joined the babies, so I'm sleeping on the floor. I've been living in Los Angeles. Exciting things about the 20th century, and one of the most lyrical poems you find now is movies in varying stages. I was always a John Wayne fan when I was very young. John, I think that's one of the dilemmas we have, one of the dilemmas that America presents, that many of America's greatest, truly greatest artists are very right-wing and reactionary, and not particularly intelligent. But they're still great. They're truly great in their own mediums. I think John Wayne is one of the greatest men ever to step in front of a screen. The John Wayne-John Ford combination was really very lyrical. And they made all the cavalry movies. And they also made some O'Neill stuff, some Irish Eugene O'Neill plays. They made a movie called The Long Voyage Home, which I saw when I was three or something. This song came from that movie, ultimately, subconsciously. It's called Pleasures of the Harbor. Which I'll dedicate to John Ford and John Wayne. Nobody can take you seriously these days. And the ship sets the sail. They've lived the tale to carry to the shore, straining at the oars or staring from the rail. And the sea bids farewell. She waves and swells and sends them on their way. Time has been her pay, and time will have to tell. Oh, soon your sailing will be over. Come and take pleasures of the harbor. The hungry hands have tied them to the port. The hour will be short for leisure on land. And the girl sang.
the air. They seem so fair, with pain upon their face. Soft is their embrace to lead them up the stairs. Oh, soon you said it will be over. Come and take the pleasures of the harbor. In the room, dark and dim, touch of skin, he asks her of her name. She answers with no shame and not a sense of sin. Till the fingers draw the blind, the sip of wine, the cigarette of doubt, the candle is blown out, the darkness is so kind. Oh, soon sailing will be over. Come and take the pleasures of the harbor. And the shadows bring the light. The same old sight, the thrill has flown away. All alone they lay, two strangers in the night. Heart skips a beat, he's on his feet, to shipmates he must join, she's counting up the coins, he's swallowed by the street. Oh, soon you said it will be over, and take the pleasures of the harbor. Hangs a cloud, the whiskey's loud, there's laughter in their eyes, the lonely in disguise are clinging to the crowd, and the bottle fills the glass, the haze is fast, he's trembling for the taste of passion gone to waste. In memories of the past. Oh, soon you said it will be over. Come and take pleasures of the harbor. In the alley, red with rain, cry of pain, for love was but a smile. Teasing all the while, now dancing down the drain. Till the boys reach the dock, they gently mock and lift him on their backs and lay him on his raft to leave beneath the light. Oh, soon you sail. The sad, they've lived the tales to carry from the shores, straining at the oars or staring from the rail, and the sea bids farewell. She waves and swells and sends them on their way. Time has been her pay, and time will have.
Next song is my apology for moving to Los Angeles, which intrigues me, like a beautiful sensual morgue. I think the final irony is that the history of Western man, when you consider the history of Western man and the Renaissance and everything else, the final chapter of Western man, I believe, lies in Los Angeles. That's where it ended up. That's true. Everybody kept moving. Everybody kept leaving. They left England to come here, and they kept moving west to colonize and colonize. Now they just get every day thousands of people arrive in Los Angeles to find the answer. And they're going to find the answer.
Don't you think it's time that we were leaving for another chance, another place to start? Desperate ones, they went across the ocean, and they wondered how it would all turn out. If you have to beg or steal or borrow, welcome to Los Angeles, city of tomorrow.
Well, that was Two by Phil Oakes. Two and a half, actually. And the actual particulars, we had a tiny taste of Outside of a Small Circle of Friends, and we had a bit of Pleasures of the Harbor, actually the whole Pleasures of the Harbor. And then we had a long title, The World Begins in Eden, and ended in Los Angeles. This is from Phil Oakes Live, Vancouver, 1968, for all you old-timers. So I'm going to begin the show tonight with a quick interview with my perennial guest in the studio and a somewhat co-hosty or hostessy person here, Katie, I believe your name is.
It's Katie.
And Katie, you've been attending various events, as well as flailing away at protests by giving out flyers on a separate but equal corner from the other protesters. I'm referring, of course, to the Cop Corner protest yesterday against the Bearcat, lack of police accountability, racial and class profiling in Santa Cruz, and sort of nasty stuff by the SCPD. Well, you also went to the Homeless Lack of Services Center's Homeless Memorial, the once of the year, we're so sorry the homeless died, now we'll do the same thing we did last year and count up the deaths next year. That's rather cynically put, I have to admit. But that's actually, it's what they actually do every year. And they do it in every city. Santa Cruz isn't the only one that does it. But they could do something else. If they really wanted to do a memorial that focused on the significance, impact, and abuse of homeless deaths, they should have a memorial every month. They should cite the people who die every month, talk about the causes of death, and maintain a tally, just like you would do with accidents of people in a factory, or workers, or individuals who are shot, or, God help me, police officers, or other people who are taking more risks than police officers, like mine workers or truck drivers whose fatality rate is much higher, or accident rate, you know, I guess it's both fatality and accident, than police officers. Though we hear a lot about our brave and loyal police officers who do so much in the line of duty. You know, all people who serve the public or who work take certain risks, and some of them just take more than others, as I said. Truck drivers, even gardeners, groundskeepers have a higher fatality rate than police officers. Police officers are very well defended. And after this new tank hits town, this Bearcat, this armored personnel carrier vehicle that Don Lane and the rest of his city council, other than Posner, voted for, and that Posner said he would have supported if only they'd agreed to be nicer next time and give people more advance notice and promise, oh, promise, promise, yes, yes, not to use it on peaceful protesters. Then he would support it, he said. And then he voted against it when they voted down even that minor token fig leaf showing how either conditioned or apprehensive the city council is in regards to the police department. We're going to be talking a bit about that, because one of the things I'm going to be doing tonight is playing all the stuff on the protests. But you have more to say about a lot of things that happened to you, or at least you've observed a number of things you were going to talk to me about. Actually, you were enthusiastic about passing on some information, both about the Homeless Lack of Services Center's memorial and also, I guess, the community TV welcome to the new director ceremony that happened today. We got a new director of community TV. Her name is Becca King Reed. I don't know who she is. I heard a lot of criticism of Kathy Bisbee, the former community TV director. Indeed, we got some of that critique from Sandra Lee, who does a regular show now again on community TV, but was doing some stuff up in Boulder Creek is where it was, because community TV was essentially simply it had dumped its staff and was simply passing on sort of government programs. It was doing simply city council, board of supervisors. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Sandy Lee held Kathy Bisbee responsible for a lot of the problems there. But I have never talked to Kathy myself about it. I knew her, I think, a decade ago, and she was part of the SCAN machine, the Santa Cruz Community Action Network, which was, a group that elected the city council on a regular basis and called itself progressive, and indeed, at some point, did take some progressive positions that the city council never took, and SCAN never had the muscle to elect these people, but never to actually get them to take positions and that honestly carried out with promises they made. Well, where do you want to start with your narrative? What about let's talk about the protest eventually, because that's going to be coming up. But because I'm going to be playing a lot of audio from that at the cop corner, as we say. But that was yesterday. What happened to you today? What did you come across at the Homeless Lack of Services Center's memorial?
Oh my goodness, how disappointing. As we were told, the age of the homeless shelter, I guess, is 18 years. And they gave us, they said, 600, give or take, dead people over their lifetime, and it averages 33 a year, but this year it was a little bit higher, and they expect it to be the same next year.
Let me interrupt you, because that is, I think, it's a caller, by cracky. Let's just see who's on the line. Hey there, caller, you're on free radio.
Hey, Robert. Hello? On Malkin.
Sorry, say that again. Hello?
Hey, Robert. It's John Malkin.
Hey, John. Thanks for calling in. I take it you weren't listening, but you just sort of called in cold?
Well, I just got home after a day out and about and got your phone message, so I'm calling in to, guessing, to talk about the ambulance that the fire department is getting.
The armored rescue vehicle, if you don't mind, sir.
It's actually, you know, in the ACLU report that looks at the militarization of police, they describe it as an armored personnel carrier, an APC, which is an army military vehicle that has been in recent years adapted for police use.
Yeah, and you actually, for those who don't know, John, you had a lengthy show last night on KZSC, KZSC, right?
Yeah.
At the university station with John Sandich and then Don Lane, the new mayor, talking about this issue. I was able to get a few words in edgewise, but I never got my question answered, which is this vehicle was, you know, essentially passed by the city council at the very end on the assurance by Deputy Chief Steve Clark that they needed to pass it or there would be a deadline for which they could not, you know, they would not be able to get the money. But when no one asked him, and I didn't hear you pressing Don Lane for this answer either, when that deadline was. I guess he didn't know. I said he seemed not understand my question. I actually followed it up with a letter this morning to him, hoping that he could. I've already asked him about a letter 2 days ago, and he hasn't responded. But you have any clues as to what the actual deadline was for the police departments accepting this money, so the city council could perhaps have a second city council meeting on it before the?
I don't know exactly. Clark gave a couple of time periods when he answered that question at the city council meeting. I think he said, let me see if I can find it. I wrote out a transcript of that. It wasn't very clear to me. It sounded like by the end of the year, part of it, and part of it by March.
I don't remember the phrase by the end of the year. I remember a specific date in March, or maybe the end of March. He did say that they had to have spent all the money by March or some such thing.
Something like that. But, I think, Robert, I think this is a really legitimate and important question to get an answer to. And it's also curious that the council didn't ask that and that they still don't know the answer to that. It's really significant that the police come to a meeting and expect a decision to be made on something, or else they hold that over the council's head. We're going to lose this money unless you make this decision today. I think what's underlying this that's very, very significant, the grant for this armored vehicle was approved in May. That's 7 months ago. The city council didn't hear about it until 2 weeks ago. On December 2nd was the first time city council or public would have possibly heard about it because they were not notified directly. And 1 week later, they were asked to vote on it. When I contacted the city manager's office, what I'm told is that is protocol for notifying city council about grants. They include it on an agenda, and then the city council discusses it. No problem. The problem is, obviously, they applied for this grant last fall, according to the police chief. In a democratic culture, one would hope that when they were thinking of applying for it and beginning to apply for it, they would have contacted city council last fall. They didn't do it then. Then when they were approved for the grant in May 2014, they also didn't contact the city council. I also find it pretty curious. I think you'll find this pretty interesting, this little detail, that when the grant was approved, when Department of Homeland Security contacted the Santa Cruz Police Department in May of this year and said, you're going to get $251,000, they did it over the telephone. And there is no written record of that. There likewise is no written record of then the police chief contacting the city manager and saying, we got approved for this grant. And then the next thing that happened was city manager waited 7 months to tell city council.
Yeah,
and,
I think we should
and
take
ostensibly
a...
the public. I mean, if you happen to have gone out to where the agenda was posted on, you know, outside at the city hall on December 2nd, you would have found out. One thing that wasn't mentioned last night, too, is that
Slow down a second. John, hang on a second, because let's go back and cover a few of those things. But keep in mind what it is you're about to say, because I don't want you to lose that point. You couldn't have seen the agenda on December 2nd, of course, because it was the 9th that the city council meeting was held. It isn't posted until the 5th or the 6th, but that's, you know, I mean, that's, and nor could you have seen it if you wanted to see it at night after 10 o'clock, because they close the council grounds, and it's an infraction crime and possibly a stay-away order if you go onto the grounds to look at the agenda. So actually, the agenda is illegally posted, has been for a couple years now. They're supposed to post it in a place where you can see it for 72 hours before the council meeting. They don't, as far as I know. There's no other place they posted and where it's available 24 hours a day. But, you know, that I only say that because it's relevant broadly to show the gross abuses and the negligence that the council, the contempt the council has for the public, although the indifference, contempt might be a little giving them too much credit for having actual emotions on these issues. I don't know if they do. But I think I want to ask you a question regarding the issue of, you may remember, I was a little ticked at you yesterday, and I think I told you in an email that you mentioned an activist alerted you to, you know, through a Public Records Act that this issue was, that they were continuing to try to get, you know, bids for and costs about and get information around, I guess, surveillance equipment. That's what we were looking for then, right? That was
I mean, there's been this period of time where we realized that the Santa Cruz police were getting grants for license plate reader cameras. It sounded like you were disappointed that I didn't mention you specifically as having been...
If I was the source. And the only reason I would be concerned about that is Good Times apparently censored my name in your story. And it's not that I'm so important. Maybe I'm wrong about that. That's what you were telling me. The story you wrote recently about, was it about license, you know, about the license, what do we call those things?
Yeah. Yeah, they actually did remove that part. And partly that I've gotten from a few activists in town the results of Public Record Act requests. I want to be really clear too.
No, okay.
That,
well, if it wasn't me, then I stand corrected. That's fine.
No. I want to make sure that you know, and I have acknowledged that in the past, and I appreciate it a lot that there was one time when you sent me Public Record Act request results, and someone else, John Colby, had combed through that and discovered this document, which ended up being an information report from June 2014, which indicated that the Santa Cruz police had applied for a second grant for license plate reader cameras. So I, by the time I got that from you and John, and that's great that we're finding that stuff out. Frankly, it's backwards. We shouldn't be searching in this blind sort of Freedom of Information Act way. City Council should be paying attention.
Oh, for sure.
By the time I got that from you guys, it was September, if I remember correctly. And when I contacted City Council people, that was the first time they heard about it. They had not seen that. I want to make sure you know, and I've told you that, and I've publicly spoken about it, that I appreciate you making Public Record Act requests and forwarding them to me. And I see that you have the same problem, if it's a problem, that I have sometimes. Sometimes we get a lot of information back that half of it isn't directly relevant. And frankly, a lot of the time it's the other way, where they're not actually sending us all the stuff we're hoping to get, too. It's a little bit of a mystery game thing, and it shouldn't be that way. I don't get it. You know, this is actually asking for information about what these people are doing in their service for us. And city council should be paying attention to that. So I was referring to a few activists who I'm getting Public Record Act requests
from.
I mean,
the reason that I mention it, John, is because I think that some of us who are, you know, trying to do this and also have rather strong opinions on the need for profound reform, if not abolition, of various police agencies as they currently exist, are considered, well, I don't want to say beyond the pale, but can sometimes be considered to be too radical or not worth listening to, or you don't want to mention their names. Don't you know? And I mean, I'm naturally a little sensitive to being considered a pariah as an individual, because I feel in being so labeled, it tends to make people regard what information I provide as less credible. So when I come up with the information that's important and credible, my name, if it's removed from that information, I think, does a discredit to the community. And the same is true with John Colby and other activists who are, some people don't like them. Some people don't like us. And some people maybe have some reason for not liking us. We all have our little personality traits. But it discredits the future information, or I think you need to allow for that information channel to open up by trying to give as much credit if you can and insisting that it be given, you know. I'm still waiting for the good times to make its emendation and correction. Actually, I'm not waiting at all, but it would be an idea.
Well, yeah. I write regularly for the good times. I have never even met in person the human being that edits my pieces, Jake Pierce.
Oh, it's no great thrill, I can tell you right now.
Steve, the editor, remembers meeting me 20 years ago, but I don't remember it. And my communication with them is very sparse.
No problem. I mean, I also want to getting back to the issue that is the one that you raised and you have been pursuing, you know, to all our advantage here. I put in a Public Records Act request that was much broader in terms of all communications with Homeland Security and other anything involving any kind of military equipment or action communications with fusion centers. All I got back was information around license plate readers. So, I mean, they completely ignored the issue of, you know, those the other documents that they had. They must have had some other documents. I think they do have other documents. But more important than that, or as important than that, is I wonder, where do you got the information that all this was done by phone by talking to Martin Bernal, the city manager?
No. It's so interesting because it's,
and again,
like I said, it's a little bit
again to tell the community what we're talking about. Again, we're talking about the Bearcat, the armored personnel vehicle that was passed on December 9th, and presumably will be available for rescue operations on the street by a late spring of this year. But that the information about it supposedly was communicated by phone and had there was no documents that happened initially last summer.
Right. So,
where did you learn this?
Yeah. So, oddly, I'd say for a couple of years, every time I write a story about anything related to the police in Santa Cruz or related to the new surveillance equipment they're getting, I contact the chief of police, the deputy chief, and usually I don't hear back anything. Occasionally I get an email that says, send me questions that you would like me to answer, and I don't get answers to those questions. This time, for some reason, I sent some questions after Chief of Police Vogel agreed to answer some questions, so I sent them to him. Here's my questions I sent him. When did the grant application process begin? Who was SCPD in communication with about the grant during the grant process? The city manager, city council. Were there any information reports written during the process? that means any reports that would have gone to City Council indicating that the process had begun. Could the grant money have been used to purchase something else? Why was this item on the City Council consent agenda? What is the cutoff date for the grant money to be spent? Is there a process for extending that date? There's your question. Who is the manufacturer and what is the make model of the vehicle? Is the vehicle a Bearcat? Would you please provide a photo of the vehicle? Would you offer two or three brief scenarios that you envision the vehicle being used for? At the City Council meeting, an amendment was offered to the resolution to accept the grant, ensuring that the vehicle would not be used during peaceful protests. Did you support that idea? Is that something you'd be willing to agree to now? Deputy Chief Martinez was quoted in the Sentinel saying that the police could have borrowed the Santa Clara vehicle during an Occupy takeover of a bank building in 2011, but decided against it. Is it accurate that Santa Cruz Police Department considered borrowing the rescue vehicle at that time? What was your impression of the public comments and questions at the City Council meeting? He didn't really go into detail about that. Is Santa Cruz Police Department currently in process with any grants for other Department of Homeland Security money, vehicles, or equipment? A few more questions, too. So eventually what I heard back kind of nothing about most of those questions, except what was quite interesting was the questions about the grant process itself. So he wrote back to me on Tuesday this week. Wow, it was just 2 days ago. He says, we submitted a project proposal to UASI, UASI, which stands for Urban Area Security Initiative, which is something I'm looking into. It's an entity created by Homeland Security that is a grant processing thing. I'm not quite sure about it. They have their own website. You can check it out, Urban Area Security Initiative. They're creating these urban area security initiatives all over the country. So he said, we submitted a project proposal to the UASI for consideration of funding the rescue vehicle in the fall of 2013. That's a long time ago. So I then wrote back to the chief and said, hey, I have two quick follow-up questions for you. And he answered, for whatever reason, I don't know why he answered me and usually doesn't. He answered saying, we received notification from UASI, which is Homeland Security, in May 2014 that our rescue vehicle project had been approved and we had been selected as a grantee for the funds. This notification came in the form of a telephone call. We received the MOU, which is
Memorandum of Understanding.
Thank you. For the grant award for the purchase of the rescue vehicle on November 1st, 2014. We received notification from Department of Homeland Security on May 14th, 2014, that we had been approved to receive the DHS grant funding for the rescue vehicle. The whole thing is Homeland Security, but the grant has been divided into two parts. One is UASI and one is DHS.
Yeah, let me skip past this, John, unless you think it's really important, because I guess the key point you're making here is a vast delay in which either the chief notified the City Council, and I would bet you dollars to donuts he notified somebody on the City Council. Somebody.
Oh, you mean like privately one person and not the whole City Council?
Yeah, or the Public Safety Committee. I mean, I think what you need to do is address some. If you want to waste more time on this, I don't think it really is a waste of time. But I mean, for example, the issues that there are so many issues on the police department, and this is a good one, obviously, for raising public awareness about how unresponsive the City Council, the City Manager, who is the real powerhouse here, the Chief of Police, who is his underling, theoretically, In San Jose, was it San Jose? I think so. They fired the city manager, with a new regime coming in, or they tried to. I'm not sure I think they did. And here in Santa Cruz, we've never fired a city manager ever that I'm aware of. And these guys are in positions for life.
Yeah.
Whether it's Dick Wilson or his Martin Bernal's predecessor, at least those are the two that were in power during my time here.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with John Malkin, who is a programmer, writer, peace activist, and also you. I ask you another question, I guess, which has to do with Don Lane, who is now our mayor again for the third time, I think it is. He was mayor in the early 90s when you did your University of California thesis on the killing of John Machado. Was that his name?
Carlos.
Carlos Machado, sorry.
Yeah, and my thesis wasn't really about that, although it affected what I was studying and doing, for sure.
And I know that you are also on the Citizens Commission for a Civilian Police Review. Actually, the Citizens Committee for a Civilian Police Review Commission, I think it was.
Yeah.
And then later on the actual Citizens Police Review Board itself, until the very same Deputy Chief Steve Clark began inquiries into your, actually revealed he kept a political file on you, and the board refused to essentially consider a complaint you made by extending the time frame in which it could be processed about Clark's behavior. Clark at that time, I think, was a sergeant. This was around the time Clark was coming to homeless protests in front of City Hall and taking everybody's blankets and then saying, and people asked him, wait a minute, why don't you take a photo of the blankets if you think it's a crime? Why are you doing this? And he turned in with his customary smirk, and I don't think that's an inaccurate thing to say about Steve Clark. He really has a smirking problem, if you want to put it that way. He said, because I can. And I think, I know I'm kind of digressing a bit to the side and getting a little personal with the police department's higher personnel, but it's not entirely personal. It has to do with policy questions, attitudes, and how these people treat issues. I mean, Clark is notorious for his attacks on liberal candidate he doesn't agree with, Laney Sherman, and his, I tend to give a few, I'm not going to spend my time, denouncing a police chief for acting like a right-wing, deputy chief for acting like a right-wing character. That's his point of view. In fact, he's doing it, of course, under the aegis of the police department. He shouldn't be paid for those kind of views. He should, do them off duty. That's how I feel about it. But, there's so many issues that we have to consider, and one of them has to do with the mayor and his lengthy apologia for the police department that he made on KZSE. I hope you can post at least part of that file on Santa Cruz Indy Media, let people hear, or maybe just take some quotes from Lane's commentary last night, which I, heard in its entirety from beginning to end.
Yeah, thanks for being there to simulcast it and record it. I have the recording, and I'm going to try and post it somewhere online where people can listen to it.
Right. Did Lane take any position at all on the Citizens Police Review Board in the early days when you and others were, getting dozens of complaints against the police department and also getting many people to sign initiatives asking for a Citizens Police Review Board? Those were in the halcyon days when people thought a police review board would actually do something. But, it was a much stronger board was originally proposed by, Margaret Marr and Sherry Connable and you and others on that, Ben Rice on the commission or the committee, whatever it was, and then it was weakened. But I mean, what was Lane's position? Did he say anything? I don't recall him ever a peep out of him, but maybe I missed it. What was your recollection on that?
Yeah, I remember a little bit about that, and I have to dig it out. I have a front page from a Sentinel article from that time. Don Lane's mother was visiting town, and there's a photo of them standing near the fountain at City Hall, and the quotes are about police review and how it's not really needed in Santa Cruz. We're not the kind of city that needs it. other places might need it. That was the general sense of what I heard from, remember hearing from Don Lane at that time, that it wasn't something really needed. And I can, let me tell you a little more about that in a second. What I just want to emphasize, too, is that regarding Don Lane and the discussion that happened last night on KZSC that was simulcast on free radio, this information that I'm describing that I got from the police chief, that is saying that they, the police here got a grant from the Department of Homeland Security for $251,000 in May and didn't tell the city council until December 2nd. The first time that Don Lane heard about that, the mayor of our city, the first time he heard that that grant actually was approved 7 months ago was when the police chief sent him an email, a copy of my email, a copy of the answers to my questions that I had asked, and he forwarded them yesterday to the mayor. It shouldn't take a journalist asking these questions for the mayor to get details about grants for armored personnel carriers coming to his town. That's how he discovered it.
What that shows, I think, John, is, as I think was evidenced by his attitude last night, and to some extent by John Sandich's, you know, love of the police department and constant, I have great respect for our police department. I have to say, I want to credit you with at least not larding your criticisms and questions when they do come with this, you know, caveat. I love the police department. I've had great help. Maybe you have, and maybe you do feel that way, but I haven't heard you say that, which to me often, strikes me often as a political statement when it comes from people. I mean, obviously, when it comes from a mayor, you might be, one might be suspicious of that. But often when I hear it coming from other people, my next question is, okay, well, when has the police department actually helped you? And usually I get this silence, you know, because it doesn't, you know, I mean, the police department has helped me on three or four occasions. You know, it's recovered my car, which has been stolen. And, you know, usually it's pretty, not that hard to get back because it's pretty, you know, it's covered with bumper stickers and you can't really mistake it. But, you know, they did get it back for me. And I always write them a letter of commendation because I think that that's a job which I'm glad anybody does. I don't know if we need to spend half the city budget on that kind of stuff. If you include the parks and rec, that's, I think, half the city budget there. But, you know, you give them credit. But the idea that I think Lane's perspective, and you're asking, you know, you're making a more general statement about, well, it shouldn't take, you know, months and months for the city council or the mayor or anybody else to hear about this. Of course, obviously not. But more important is his lack of concern about that issue. Did he seem to you concerned about that at all?
About it not, having taken so long?
Yeah, about his not having not been informed about it.
Frankly, I'm a little surprised he didn't express more concern about that.
I'm not a little surprised at all. I mean, I think that because Lane, I think they want to leave these matters, whether it's DSAL or the police department or ADUs, you name it, they want to leave it to the other departments. They do not want to be burdened with these issues. They want to get the stuff from the staff, have a little token debate, if any is required, and then push it through. And, you know, I mean, have you noticed, and there are probably some, you know, specific exceptions to that, but how would you feel about that formulation?
I think that's part of it. Like you're talking about the bureaucratic aspect of it. I think that's part of it. But I think your earlier point is more interesting, that the way that people communicate with and about police and military, I think you're part of how this could be explained is if you're going to say anything that might sound like a criticism of the people who are sanctioned with using violence in our communities, you might want to be a little careful and throw them a few compliments, because in the end, they could end up shooting at you or trying to put you in jail. Or on another scale, there's some law enforcers in our country who apparently have designed and think it's quite legal and morally all right to torture people, to bring them near death, to fight crime. So I think, I mean, one of the callers last night, Paul Sprawl, who used to live in Santa Cruz, he called from quite far away, brought up this point. That's an interesting question. Kind of like, you know, the old story of, you know, how would the fish describe the water they live in? I mean, it's where they are. It's hard to know something different. How would you know when you're living in a police state? Well, I think one indication of that could be that you're afraid to ask the police to do something differently. Or, yeah. You know, kind of what you're pointing out, you're going to withdraw your concerns that you have. You're not going to express them directly because you're afraid of them.
You know, I think the police also get the benefit of this massive mythology. I was talking about this on the air before you called in, about their supposed vulnerability and their bravery and how, you know, how incredibly dangerous their job is. And I have yet to get deeper into the research, but I continue to repeat the preliminary findings from admittedly a police critic who writes in his book Our Enemies in Blue, which you probably have read.
Oh yeah, you mentioned that you're looking at that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, his claim is, and he cites you know, I guess it's US Department of Labor statistics, that fatalities for people in mining and truck driving and other professions are many times that of the police department. I mean, police is pretty well armed, pretty well protected, and people are scared of them. And it also has to be said that the police are, you know, in the position essentially of intervening in a lot of situations in an aggressive way, particularly with the drug war going on, in ways that if a normal person did it, they get the shit beat out of them, and other people would wonder, why the hell aren't you minding your own business?
Well, yeah, I see what you're saying, and it could be true statistically. I don't see it as that valuable of an argument to make to say that their job isn't that hazardous.
Why not? If it's factually true. See, I think it's a mythology. You got to fight the mythology. If it is a mythology, if it is true, certainly we should acknowledge it as a truth and, you know, and give it due weight. But if it isn't true, then we have to fight it because it is constantly claimed to be true.
Yeah. Well, what I would say is more to the point is, regardless of what's true or not, it's how that information is being used, and one could make the same. I mean, it's important. This is really, really important what you're bringing up. Nationally, obviously, the airplanes that were flown into the towers on September 11th, it has a different meaning and a different impact different people. So some people have used that imagery and that true thing that happened for particular purposes, to increase the control, government control, and to implement surveillance, all in the name of making sure that doesn't happen again. So that's what police do also.
Sure.
And they use the myth you're describing to do that too. I think that's what needs to be stopped, for sure.
We're talking with John Malkin. By the way, we have another phone line here. If anybody got any questions for John or for me or comments about this, phone number here is 469-3119, 469-3119. I'm going to have to – you've got probably things to do, too, but I've got another caller probably be calling in about 5 or 10 minutes, so I'm going to –
Yeah, that's perfect. I have like 5 minutes.
Okay. The question really for a lot of us is, what's the next step? I heard I mentioned on the air there was a protest coming up tomorrow. I understand it's kind of a think it's a lone person protest, from what I understand, although I haven't been able to contact the person who's throwing it. There's a person who's going to be picketing in front of a parking garage across from New Leaf Market in order to, it's mentioned on Santa Cruz Indie Media for those who want to look at indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz Indie Media. And it's happening from 5 to 8, according to the posting. It has to do with, you know, we're going to deny the city money in the parking lot because we don't like the way they're allowing the police department to run rampant over at least the public opinion of everybody who came to the city council, use a process that doesn't allow public opinion to even generate itself, as you have been pointing out. So that's coming up. Again, 469-3119, if anybody wants to call in and ask Sean a question. Did you have any, any subsequent conversations with Lane? I got a long letter from him. It was a sort of an apologia. I guess I sent it to you, or maybe he sent it to you independently. Some of it was simply a repetition, I think, of what he said on the air. Is that, oh well, they, you know, we could have used a rescue vehicle to help with the guy who escaped from the custody of a deputy sheriff, and, you know, ran into a school and held hostages and so forth. And I'm not going to poo-poo that, but I'm certainly also not going to bend over for that. When you were, rather to me, I found it, I was a little uncomfortable with your silence in the face of that, though I can understand that you know, he was confronting you with that. And I guess, you know, our brave sergeant, I harass the homeless and have a great time doing it, Butchie Lauren Baker, who, you know, got shot down a year and a half ago, along with Elizabeth Butler, who also does not get a lot of plaudits in my book, by the way, for her policing against poor people. That doesn't mean they should be shot down. No, it doesn't mean they should be glorified either and used in the 9/11 fashion to which you've been talking, which you've been referring to. And did you learn anything from Lane after that, or did you guys just sort of ride away on separate horses?
What I can say about that is this is a point that deserves much more attention, and we barely went into it, frankly, last night. And the point being, that where I forgot what I was going to say.
You're dumbstruck, John, and this is a rare moment. I must say.
Here's my point. Yeah. Here's my point, Robert. This is kind of a bottom line thing. All across the country, police departments are getting these armored personnel carriers.
Rescue vehicles, please.
Yeah, and they're all arguing the same thing. There has been something that has happened in their community that this vehicle could have been used to help out at. Or they're projecting into the future if there is a natural disaster or if there's a shooting situation. Officers can climb in this tank-like thing and get close to what's happening without being harmed.
Well, the civilians also get mowed down, of course.
There's a lot of articles. I would encourage people to look online and look at the ACLU report about this. It's increasingly true that these vehicles are being used in cases where they weren't intended and actually are illegal. They're kind of stretching the boundaries, police, in how they're using these to serve search warrants, drug busts. So the bottom line thing that I'm talking about is just because the police say this tool will help us fight crime, that's not enough for them to get that tool. That's actually why we have the Bill of Rights and why there are laws that limit what police can do.
Or used to limit what police could do.
There have been times and places on this planet where the police and or military have said, you know, we'd really like to be able to enter anyone's home whenever we want, because it'll really cut back on crime. And those times and periods are examples now of fascism and really dark periods.
Or examples of how homeless people are treated in Santa Cruz, for example.
Yeah. So That's why that's not a deep enough argument. If that was all you needed to get new tools and equipment and tactical ideas was to say it'll help us do what we want to do.
I gotcha.
Go for it. Go for it. You know, if that's the only requirement.
Katie has a question for you, John.
Okay.
Hey, John, yesterday I was talking to a gentleman who is very much in favor of the Bearcat, and this is what he said. When this vehicle is needed, it will not be needed on my home because I have a relationship with the police. They work for my family. They protect my community. When this machine is needed, it will be needed on people like you. And that was me because I was protesting.
Indeed. You know, and my response to that, I'll let you respond too, John, is in a way what my response would be to your statement earlier, John, that... Well, people don't, they're apprehensive about police. They want to be complimentary to the police because someday they may find themselves on the business end of a billy club or a macing canister or, you know, a little hot lead, which is done only, of course, to defend the community and all that. And that's always a risk in this society. But if people people think about that primarily, we are in a police state, period. We cannot allow that kind of fear to stop us. And I don't. I mean, police officers, when I see police officers, and I suggest this to the community, you talk to the man, not the badge. And you can scorn the uniform and demean the department, but as long as you respect the person, that's what really counts. That's what I find. So when I criticize the police, and I do quite verbally, I had my Fuck the Police t-shirt on yesterday in this protest, and we were in front of the police department. You know, I mean, and yes, that makes you a target to some extent. But the fact of the matter is also power tends to respect power far more than it respects weakness. And I think that people who think they can hide out from these issues are really showing a kind of weakness in this issue rather than power. And this is sort of secondary to this conversation in a way, although maybe even more primary. But I want to end with this question to you, which is, and this is a concern I'm having, with all this focus on the Bearcat, which is, you know, one vehicle, and yeah, it's militarization, no question. But what about, you know, the other more profound things that are happening in the police department that impact us all in the day-to-day? The Bearcat is not going to be used, much in the day-to-day, I imagine. But what do we face every day on Pacific Avenue? What do we face every day, you know, in terms of how minorities are treated and homeless people are treated in Santa Cruz? I mean, even the license plate stuff that the ACLU gets into, and it's, you know, and I agree, you know, it's obviously intrusive surveillance. There's massive surveillance, as you pointed out, not just by the NSA. You know, but I suspect that we don't have any sense of how much surveillance is going on by our local police departments. We don't have any monitoring. We don't know what cameras. I put in requests to find out what kind of cameras are being used downtown and around town to surveil people. Haven't gotten responses of any meaningful sort. And as you point out, when you ask a question of the police department, they should come back with a very simple, clear, and timely answer. They won't do it to you, and they don't do it to the city council. And the city council is so cowed, it doesn't even ask, even under massive public pressure, as happened on December 9th. So, I don't know. I mean, these are things, I don't want to see us focusing all our time on Bearcats and license plate, recognition and surveillance equipment. Although I think, you know, definitely you bring it up. But you consider how in the course of the day, the kind of privileges and power and the amount of resources being given to the police department of Santa Cruz generally. And this is something that's harder to go to address because people believe that the police department is, as it's currently constituted and funded and equipped and behaves, is a necessity. It's being done for your own good. And these are all harder things to contest and to address than going after these single issues that you put a lot of focus on. And I think I'm not saying it's wrong that you do, but I'm trying to find a way to broaden this whole discussion and debate. Any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, it sounds like you want to make sure that the day-to-day activities the police are involved in are also a focus and addressed, and you want to make sure people are safe and not being treated badly by the police day-to-day here in Santa Cruz. I feel the same, of course. And it's all interconnected, all of these things. The police, I mean, underlying all of this, I want to say that I think a lot of people don't realize this, and this trust in the police is an interesting thing because police have always ended up using the tools that they have, whatever they happen to be during a period of time. They've always used their tools to disrupt democratic movements and to disrupt democratic participation in society. That's just true. The FBI and local police departments, all the way from infiltrating organizations, peaceful organizations, to assassinating people like Mark Clark and Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers, dropping a bomb on the MOVE house. I mean, that wasn't the U.S. Army. That's police doing these things. And now widespread surveillance. So I'm disappointed to hear that you think of these realms as being separate or too specific from what you're concerned about. I see them as totally interconnected. And I think homeless people in Santa Cruz, the way they're treated, and anyone else in Santa Cruz is going to be affected. The way that police treat people is affected by their ideas and by the equipment they're sitting in and
sure.
behind.
I agree with you, John, but the problem is, consider they'll have a huge forum on license plate recognition stuff. The ACLU will go into that at length, but there's no forum on the nightly destruction of homeless encampments. There's no forum on abuses of people in Pacific Avenue. There's no forum on the on a lack of police accountability in Santa Cruz. And the last time that happened, it was only when it became obvious that Sarah Hillman and nine other women were saying that Butchie Baker was fondling them in inappropriate searches back in 1991 and 1992. Instead, you have all these liberal groups focusing on very particular issues of equipment. Which I agree with you, of course that impacts people, but there are things that are broader and more immediate that are happening now that I think that are pointedly ignored or only given token lip service to, which is what I hear you doing here. What shows have you done on homeless harassment in Santa Cruz in the last 5 years by the police department? Maybe you have. I haven't been listening to your shows with the regularity I should, perhaps if I want to make that kind of a statement, but you can tell me now.
Well, you regularly ask me that, and I tell you I have done shows on that and on everything I could think of relating to police. And every, when I have a particular encounter, it tends to inspire me to write something about it or do a show about it. So I had an encounter that didn't happen not to involve homeless people. But I went to pick up my son from school a year ago, and there were young people with toy guns in Lighthouse Field, which I didn't know at the time. But when I arrived there, there were half a dozen Santa Cruz police officers with semi-automatic assault rifles standing next to a group of 20 children. And so I filed a complaint about that and did radio about that, and I'm doing writing about that because I'm concerned about the weaponry and the communication that police have in that kind of circumstance. It was not safe from my point of view, and they created a buffer zone, that was their language, at the school. And the children were standing there next to the cops with AR-15s. It didn't make sense to me. So I took some interest in that. And when I hear about homeless people getting getting harassed, I interview them and talk to them, and when I encounter whatever level. I remember a lot of different stories, because during the period of 92 to 95, I was on the street collecting complaints from...
I'm talking about the period of the last two or three years, John, the last 5 years.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, and remember, this example you just gave, and it's, you know, a very dramatic example, but it's an unusual example, at least in terms of what you see in Santa Cruz on a day-to-day basis.
Not unusual for me, man. That was the third time that my son is 7 years old. He's seen police officers with guns drawn three times in his life.
This
so
is all
far.
For your safety, John.
It's about the fifth time I've seen AR-15s exhibited by Santa Cruz police. Those are army guns.
And I'm glad you bring that point up. But you don't need army guns to engage in abuses of, you know, poorer people in Santa Cruz. I mean, particularly if people are compliant. By the way, Katie has got a question, and then I'm going to give you the last word. Go ahead.
Well, I have to run, and I think I feel a little uncomfortable with the way that you were talking to me just a moment ago, saying that you think I'm avoiding these issues, and I think it would be useful if you actually checked in and saw, and even the accusation that there's forums about certain things and not other things, I think it would be valuable if you checked in and saw if that was actually true.
I mean, do you have some examples of forums that have happened that the ACLU or the NAACP?
I
haven't seen them. Maybe you have, and
no,
I know you're uncomfortable. I'd
point.
Be uncomfortable too. I mean, if I were confronted with this stuff, for sure.
Oh, me too. I agree. You would be uncomfortable because I don't even know of a forum on license plate readers. I don't know what you're pointing to.
I'm referring to the. You don't remember that?
I've not heard that is going to happen.
You were on the forum. It happened in February, I believe.
Oh, that discussion about the surveillance cameras.
Right. Right.
Oh, geez, that was like a one-night thing.
Yeah, but at least there was a one-night thing, you know, I mean...
Oh, give me a break. There's been no one-night things about homelessness in Santa Cruz?
Not that the ACLU has been putting on, or that individuals who are...
It's not even interesting, Robert, your argument now. I'm sorry. I really hope that you... I appreciate the...
I think it's a classist thing,
work
John.
...that you do, and it's... I don't appreciate the way that you communicate with me about it, and that's unfortunate, and I know that that's kind of a problem that's
you sound defensive.
Ongoing, so
you sound defensive.
I appreciate what you're doing, and I don't appreciate the way you communicate
and
about it.
And I appreciate what you're doing, John, and I understand you sound a bit defensive about these issues, and I would be too, as I said. And I think you're right. I think I should check into these things for sure, and I try to, and that's one of the reasons I raised them with you, because if you have additional information, I'm always happy to hear it. That's all. And I do appreciate you taking time to call in on this, you know, on this matter. And when will you be playing a second version of a replay of your show? Is there a regular time? I guess we don't have a regular time, right?
My show is on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock, so it'll be on then. And my shows are often rebroadcast at all hours of the day and night.
At all hours, yes, mine too. So that particular show will be rebroadcast next Wednesday. Cool. And thanks for calling in, John. And, don't take it personally. It's not intended personally.
Well, it is actually personal because it's you talking to me, and I don't enjoy how you do that. And I've talked to you about that a bunch, and I'm happy to... I'm frustrated with that, but I'm willing to talk more about that.
I hope so.
And I hope that shifts, but...
Yeah. Well, no, I think, let's talk more when you have time. And again, we're going to disagree, and we might even get frustrated and even upset with each other, but that shouldn't stop us from continuing to review these subjects, I think. I'm going to try not to let it stop me, anyway.
Okay.
Hey.
Have a sweet evening.
And you too, John. Bye-bye. So, Katie, was I too harsh there with John on the air? What do you think?
I do. I've heard it lots of times, Robert, but I enjoy working with you, and I seem to ebb and flow with you. But a number of people have said to me, how do you work with him? He is so critical. He frustrates me. I try to explain something to him, and he twists it around, and he makes these accusations, and it's like, yeah, well,
me? Twist it around? I'm not aware that I did that with anything John was saying, but, I mean, I obviously raised the issue that, you know, he's a lot of people think they are engaged in more. A lot of people in this country, myself included, are not aware of how, for example, racist or classist or sexist we are. And it's not that we intend to be. It just it happens because of the, you know, as John might put it, because of the stream in which we swim. You know, because it's, you know, if you're a fish, you don't notice the water. And that's American society as we're currently in it. Anybody got calls? You're welcome to call in and give some thoughts. And you too, Katie, at 427-3772 is the call-in number. Actually, let's make it 469-3119 because I'm hoping to get a call from Robert Aguirre of San Jose, who is an activist in the homeless movement over there and who was recently displaced by the San Jose police in the jungle, the largest, described as the largest homeless encampment in the country. I don't know if that's actually true, but Katie, you had a question, a comment, a thought?
Well, my thought with the police is before my arrest in 2011, the police were, I got along with them really well. I took my children to them. I did activities at the school. And all of a sudden, they've become these intimidating people. You cannot sit down and talk with them about your issue or protecting you. It's dumbfounding to me how all of a sudden this relationship with police, they have become these authoritarian, frightful figures. And that's just not how it should be.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, once you become, want to raise certain topics, the police may appear to be, you know, very friendly and fine, provided you stick within certain parameters. And people who are well kind of conditioned to both see the police as their friends and also to give a heightened and I think overly exaggerated sense of respect to police because of the uniform, their positions and so forth, don't even think of asking certain questions. And they also treat police as authorities. That's people who would know more than they do. People whose wisdom is deeper and stronger than theirs. People who have, you know, more knowledge and more experience and all that, which in some cases may be true, but is not necessarily true. And so when you approach people as an equal in that regard, when they expect you to be, in essence, treating them as a higher up, then you're going to get a different kind of response from them. And people who are not, haven't had bad experience with the police or don't have serious questions to ask or observed others having bad experiences, aren't even going to ask questions because it goes against the grain of the mythology that the police are here to protect us, that they're a proper and necessary part, that the abuses are the exception rather than the rule, that all is fundamentally okay. And if it isn't okay, it'll be corrected. And if it hasn't been corrected, at least it isn't happening here. And if it is happening here, there are channels to go through to deal with. There's a whole series of pretexts and series of, you know, rationales that come up.
I think when you're a middle-class citizen going about your 9-to-5 day or your soccer mom life, as I was oblivious to living in and around the police activity. I just didn't see. I mean, I taught my children to respect the police. I didn't teach them to fear them. I said, if you have a problem and you're feeling concerned for your safety, go to the police.
Is that what you do today?
You know, absolutely not. No, I would not. And once I started living in the world of police protection, I was, come on, It's how do you defend yourself? How do you try to make yourself credible? Oh, I've been a Republican all my life. Oh, I've done this. Oh, I've done.
You're talking about when you were out, when you were outside, when you're homeless.
Right. Well, yeah. So all of a sudden, yeah. You see, you know, you have a home and you're doing your routine and you don't need the police. And then all of a sudden, you're on the street and you need them, and they're not there because you're not.
Or they're there when you don't want them to be. I mean, that's another
exactly.
issue.
Or they're surveilling you. You know.
So I've got interviews now. Yeah, no, I mean, of course, that's a lot of the issues from a lot of the people on this show. And I guess let's get you to talk about the memorial, because this is something that happens every year in Santa Cruz, and you were talking about it before. Maybe you should reiterate what you were saying. It started, I guess, at 10 or 10:30 this morning at the Homeless Lack of Services Center. The was it outside in the
no,
bay?
No, it was indoor. It was indoor.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And, you know, it was set up very... very inexpensively, and the only person I saw there was Don Lane from the city. I was very disappointed that the chief of police and the city manager and all these people that we tolerate were not present and accounted for.
No Micah Posner?
I didn't see Micah Posner, no.
Okay.
I did not.
No Cynthia Chase?
I did not see Cynthia Chase.
No. Deputy Chief Steve Clark, perhaps?
There were no uniforms there. There was not a single police uniform there. And it was very disappointing because a number of the people who died this year were actually people I met at Occupy and really had a fun time with. You know, I'll drop just two, Baltimore and Bobby McGee. When Bobby McGee was the road man, it was roadie for Janis Joplin, lost his ass in the Vietnam War. Literally, they blew his ass off. And then his wife died of cancer, and you know. Anyway, he died this last year. And just from being with him during Occupy, he had all the potential in the world to live to 75. Or older.
He was also a singer and guitarist.
Oh, he's wonderful. Wonderful. So it was very sad to me to learn the number of names that I met at Occupy who died this year.
How many people died that they noted?
37.
And you said they made some other comments about this?
They did. They said the average is 33, and the average homeless person lives to be between 50 and 53. The youngest one to die this last year homeless was 16. They didn't talk much about the causes. They did defend, you know, the few who made it into homes weeks before they died. Well, at least he died in a bed. At least we finally got him into a housing situation. So the last few days of his life, we found his family.
How many homeless people were there?
When I first arrived at 9 o'clock this morning, there must have been 300 homeless people out gathering their things. Were all wet. Everyone seemed to get along remarkably well. It was just an amazing collection of wonderful people.
Well, they weren't there for the memorial, were they? They were there for the breakfast? And
they had slept there. Lots of them had been sleeping there. And yet
so they slept there beyond the Pauley Loft capacity?
It appeared that way.
Good.
It appeared they were sort of piled on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that started to break up. Security moved them here and there. And I watched that for as long as I could tolerate it. Because I get these mixed things. Everybody's like, oh, the homeless shelter, they're such wonderful people. I found them, excuse me, I found them mean, rude. But I was told this is how we have to treat these people. We have to have a routine. We have to be strict with them. We have rules. If they don't follow them, they need to be asked to leave.
Did you see anybody asked to leave?
Several people.
For doing what?
I'm not quite sure. I wasn't all that comfortable with the people who were being confronted for... I'm not sure. There was an accusation, you stole something from me, and they kicked the whole party out. They just told them all, get out of here. You know, we're not dealing with this.
So there were 300 people initially when you got there. This was after the breakfast meal, or?
Yes. They were cleaning up the breakfast meal,
mm-hmm.
I guess. And then they opened the door at 10:30 to go in. The media went first. KSBW, Phil Gomez was there. John Colby was there. I went as his guest So I was considered a media person, and that was rather nice to sit in there and talk. I'd say the room was, you know, there was a standing wall in the back, so maybe, I don't know, maybe 50 or 60 people. Most of them were homeless. Most of them were very emotional about what happened. And then I found the speakers at the homeless shelter to be full of bullshit.
What about what they said concerned you?
Oh, we love these people. We cared. They didn't even know who Baltimore was, number one. This woman that I spoke to, Shelley, I don't know how to pronounce her last name, M-E-K-I-T-T-R-I-C-K. I asked her about Baltimore. Oh, I don't know who he was. Baltimore died of cancer. Finally, they found him housing. But the last time I saw him 2 years ago, he was living on the street. He was in pain. He was carrying around three different drugs he needed to take all the time. And then, you know, she didn't know who he was, so that bothered me. And they're less than sincere. They have everything.
She made a public speech, or she just spoke to you?
She spoke. A number of them spoke, and they were all teary-eyed. And every year this happens. Every year we lose. We've lost up to 600, or maybe they said 550, give or take. Somebody's used the word give or take. And I almost stood up and screamed. Oh, is this a matter of give or take? How long have you been in business? How many millions of dollars have been spent on this facility? This facility is falling apart. Is that the homeless's fault? Apparently so. I mean, that's what you want it to look this way.
What about the homeless lack of service center is falling apart in your view?
It's moldy. There's mold all over the place. People don't see that. They think I'm telling stories. There's mold, there's leaky faucets, the windows are cracked, they're not sealed properly, there's mold running down the water in the water, what are they called, the pipe, the water, the you know, where water runs down, what's that called, around the house that you have the trim?
Gutters.
Gutters, thank you. They're not connected properly, so the water's running down the building. It's green and black mold. Nobody can see that but me.
Have you ever complained about that to the authorities there?
You know, everything I have complained about has fallen on deaf ears, and that includes every single council member, every authority, every city manager, every supervisor.
Did you actually complain to any authorities at the Homeless Lack of Services Center about the mold?
Not specifically about the mold, but in 2011 I went there and I stood outside for several hours and I wrote down what I saw. I saw drugs, I saw alcohol, I saw security abuse, I saw money exchanging hands between employees and the clients. But no, you have to have all of that on video camera. I did go to the county supervisors. I went to a
did you have you have you complained about any of the actual health conditions there that you observed this year at any time this year?
No, I have not.
Okay, because while it's tempting and passionate to vent on the radio, and it's helpful, and I know it's probably useless, as you point out, to make these complaints to the authorities. It's appropriate to do that because then you have, of course, a paper trail and a record that. Yes, you went through the established channels, and look what happened. More important, I mean, I don't mind if you raise the issues here either, but I want them to be, if I can, I want them to be specific, and I want them to be contemporary. I want them to be relatively recent, because and that's why I keep kind of, you know, choking you every time you talk about 2011, although that was a period of time when you were outside and when you were homeless, and, you know, that was a... Although
it was a sobering experience. I had never lived with homeless people.
Right, but in point is, see, I mean, it's all... That's, you know, an important and passionate for you, and that's of interest to some extent, but more of interest is what you see objectively these days, and also what you feel personally. And so if you... what else happened at the Homeless Lack of Services Center at the memorial? How long did it last?
The memorial probably lasted 30 or 40 minutes, and it was very uneventful. There was a wonderful, you know, a gal who sang, and it was very pleasant. And
poetry, I imagine, from Mama Joy, perhaps?
She sang. It was pleasant. She was very nice.
Did Monica Martinez speak? You don't know?
I'm not very good with their names.
Monica Martinez was the former Homeless Lack of Services Center director.
Oh, she's retired.
Oh, yes. Yeah, a couple years ago.
Oh.
Or a year ago, at least. And have you had any? Did you have any communication with the new director of Homeless Lack of Services Center? I don't know her name actually. But there is a new director there.
I stood in line to speak with her for several minutes, and she had to go respond to a phone call or something. And the last couple people that were sort of standing in this collection, waiting to be introduced or to speak to her, we were just left. Oh, well.
Mm-hmm. Any homeless people die this last year who are mentioned, or perhaps who weren't mentioned, other than Baltimore and Bobby McGee, that you know or that you remember?
At least 20. There were at least 20 names, and if they had had the faces up there, I would have probably fallen apart. They don't have any.
Do you remember any other names, sir?
I'm not off the top of my head.
How about the homeless speakers who came up? Usually what they have done in the past, they have, everyone leaves a flower and it kind of floats in a pond and light a candle, that sort of thing.
You could float in water. There were a couple homeless people that stood up and told their stories and, expressed anger over the, big pharmacy drugs. How so many people are suffering from pain, how vulnerable they are, how the police just aren't there for these people, how the drugs and the doctors aren't recognizing what's going on, and all of these people are labeled as an expense, as worthless, as ugly, and the people at the homeless shelter, we don't want that to happen. We want zero homelessness, overnight, as if. They've ignored this for so long. Now the problem has escalated. And who are they blaming?
So how many homeless people would you say spoke at this?
Two.
And how many speakers were there?
Three or four. The gentleman from the Circle Church was there. He announced that he's leaving the area.
Oh, Steve Fields DeGambrill?
He spoke and very passionately, and then he announced that he's leaving the area.
Did he announce he was reopening the warming center in the morning?
No, all he did say was he's leaving the area.
Was there any statement about about warming facilities that would be opened up or any kind of shelter? Because I understand that they're maxed out both at the armory and at the shelter. And I guess you're saying what they're doing is in a de facto way. They're letting people sleep there on the grounds. Is that what you observed, or...?
That is what I observed when I first...
How many people were sleeping there, do you know?
Oh, the people I saw were extremely frail and old. I counted 17 people that had to have been over 60 that were just knocked out.
You can't really tell me if they were sleeping when you came up? Or?
They were sleeping.
No, how many people do you think slept there that night is what I was saying?
I don't know, but when I arrived, there had to have been 300 people there.
Fair enough. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to try to reach Robert Aguirre in San Jose and see if I can get his report on life in the jungle or life hiding in the jungle. Let's see if we can get through to him. I talked to him earlier right before the show, and I asked him to call in, but the conversation with John Malkin went very long, and I don't think he may have been unable to get through. We'll see if we can get a hold of him. He may call us back. That's his usual way. He's an activist.
Your call has been forwarded to an automated
who actually lives or was living in the jungle,
9,
I believe.
1-5-4
which is the area,
7,
I think, near
1,
the
8,
the river.
7,
in San Jose.
4 is not available.
And
they're
evolving a strategy for exposing the,
for more options.
As you might call it, bullshit of the authorities. Hey there, Robert. This is Robert Norris calling at Free Radio. I'm calling you from a second line, 831-469-3119. In case you want to call in, do call me back, and we'll do it. That could be him. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert and Katie.
Hi, this is Robert Geary. I'm calling in.
Hey, Robert. Good to hear you. Now, what is this homeless organization that you... I'm kind of curious what H-O-M-E-L-E-S-S stands for. Does that actually stand for a bunch of words?
Yes, it does stand for a bunch of words, and it stands for more than just words. It's an actual movement that we have, and it's the homeless organization motivating and expressing legal equality of our social status.
Huh. And give that to me one more time.
Okay. Homeless organization motivating and expressing legal equality of our social status.
Gotcha. And how long has this organization been in existence?
Let's see. We started sometime before August. I think it was maybe June or July. I don't recall the exact date for that.
And what exactly do you guys do, and how many are you?
We're an advocacy group, and we advocate for homeless people throughout the entire, Santa Clara County area is what we focus on. And the numbers have changed. They go up and down all the time because people join our group, and then they drop out for different reasons, and people come and go all the time. But we have a core group of maybe about 10 people that are currently active and continue to be active.
And do you guys have an online website? Is there a number that people can call if they want to be supportive and so forth?
We're kind of low-tech, so no, we don't have a website. And one of the reasons we don't have a website is because we're kind of an underground kind of movement in that wherever the homeless go, the city is hunting us. So if we start posting information on a website, and people certainly want to know where you are because they want to be able to come and offer help, well, at the same time, we're informing the city of where we are, and the city just goes and runs us off.
Well, I know that in Fresno, for example, Mike Rhodes, who's a longtime activist, and there they had some permanent encampments that were, I'm not sure if they were more or less permanent than yours, probably somewhat more permanent because, as you probably know or might know, in Fresno, they won the Kincaid lawsuit in 2007, got $2.3 million from the city, and so continued to have homeless encampments that were of a semi-permanent nature under the freeways until about a year ago when the city began cleaning them out, that is to say, destroying them and dispersing people to more dangerous situations throughout the city. Rhodes was a guy who provided, through the organization he was working with, I think it was the Fresno Community Homeless Alliance or something, porta potties, garbage pickups, toilet paper, things of that sort. We're talking about, pretty primitive shit, but important to deal with shit, so
to speak. Absolutely. That's part of the reason why the jungle closed down was because the city was complaining about the pollution, the trash, and the possibility of E. coli. And I don't know if they ever found any, but
I thought that was the pretext, Robert, not the actual reason. Not the reason is that the reason they usually close this stuff down is either there's an election coming, or they want to redevelop the area, or they're going to spruce it up for some tourist event that's happening, or some right-wing vigilante pressure group in town wants to raise its property values. The pretext they used, I've noticed, are different in different places, but they're actually kind of the same. And almost like they're taken out of a playbook, your environmental hazards, you're all taking shits all over, but there are no places to take a shit, there are no bathrooms.
Right.
So
exactly.
What the fuck are you talking about? That's one. Number two, you're a public safety hazard because, you leave your trash around. Well, there are no trash pickups and, that there's no dumpsters available. Dumpsters are locked. You're a public safety hazard because somebody got, you're frightening the children. And there's the perception of danger that we just can't have in this city. That's the big thing they're using in Santa Cruz or have been throughout the last year or two. But the reasons are having to, are really usually something much more commercial or have to do with the aesthetics of some sort of upper class property values. But what area was actually cleared out in San Jose, and how long had you lived there, if you had lived there at all?
Yes, I did live there. The area was where Center Road dead ends into Story Road, and it was like 68 acres, approximately. It was, I guess, slightly smaller than 68, but right around 68 acres. And it used to be much larger than that. But what the city started doing is closing down encampments throughout the entire city. And they started, when people would say, well, where do we go? They say, well, go to the jungle. So they started directing people. So in effect, they actually created this problem. As they continued to close other encampments, and then people started moving in, it became more and more dense. As it became more dense, it became, more filthy, if you will. The city decided 2 years ago that they were not going to do any trash pickup, and they had a contract with this organization called Downtown Street Team, but Downtown Street Team was never fully capable of keeping up with the amount of trash that was being generated, and so it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And the people that lived there even offered to clean it up. We asked if we could get paid for doing it, but when they said no to that because of a liability, and I really don't understand the difference between the liability of people that live there cleaning their own trash and the people that are hired that are also homeless, that are hired by Downtown Street Team to come and work for them at $5 an hour. They have to sign a release, and they go and they clean up trash all over. And since the jungle's been closed, they started a new program, which is called a Gateway, where they're cleaning up on ramps and off ramps of the freeway. And these are being sponsored by different corporations. I think TiVo was one of the first ones to step up. So now they have a big sign at one of the entrances: "Welcome to San Jose. TiVo invites you to enjoy your stay," or whatever the wording is. But the thing is that the homeless are actually being used and, I think, abused to do that. They also have another program. It's called Groundworks, where they keep the entire downtown area clean. And there's people with push brooms, and they're going around cleaning the streets at all times and the sidewalks. So, when you come into downtown San Jose, like you said, people like to have this real pretty, immaculate sort of look to the city. So they have these homeless people that they're hiring to do that. And I think they're really taking advantage of that. They do this with the promise of housing, but yet there's people that have been there for years that have no housing. And, I don't understand how they, how their program works if they are promising housing to people and not really delivering it to all of them.
What kind of an area is the 68-acre area that the city drove homeless people into and then drove homeless people out of?
Okay, well, that's a creek. It's called the Coyote Creek, and it's fed by a reservoir called Anderson Reservoir, which is down by Gilroy, and which is south of San Jose, and it flows out to the bay near Alviso, which is a city that's north of San Jose. So this is a waterway that doesn't really flow very fast, and even with the rains that we got right now, it wasn't really threatening anybody. But again, that was another excuse that they gave, that all of a sudden, people are going to drown. But, we're not turkeys. We're smart enough to know when the water comes, you get out of the way.
That was an excuse also used here in Santa Cruz to clear out. Actually, it did clear out Camp Paradise when we had a camp on the San Lorenzo River in 2001. We, not being me, I didn't live there, but a lot of people who I knew did. And then when it was cleared away, they didn't allow people to come back. And they're regularly defoliating and patrolling the river now, again, to deal with the menace of the homeless. Go ahead.
Right. The same thing that happens here. There's a number of things that they've done that they've claimed is in the interest of restoring the riparian life that existed there, and they're concerned about the steelhead trout, where they used to come and spawn through there. They talk about that like it's a big deal. I went to the Water District board meeting the night before last, and I told them it's wonderful that you're interested in saving the natural habitat, the plants and the fish and all the animals that live around there. I said, but we have people here that we're dealing with. We're not dealing with objects. So when you displace people, you're displacing persons. You're not just, because they had this chart that showed how many camps they had closed, how many people were arrested, you know, how many tons of garbage they collected, and how many, you know, just all these numbers and facts and, you know, a little spreadsheet, and it looked really nice and neat, and it showed all the different creeks that they had cleaned out, Guadalupe, Coyote, just all these different places where they had cleaned out homeless people, and the homeless people were just a statistic. And so when I spoke to them about checking their privilege. You know, people that live in standard traditional homes don't realize what it's like to be living outdoors. They don't realize what it's like to have to worry about where your meal's going to come from the next day, or where your clothes are going to come from, or you know, any of the number of things that people that are homeless need to deal with. And people are homeless for all sorts of different reasons. There's no one single solution that's going to solve all of homelessness, even though they pretend that that's what they're going to do. So, until this society really realizes what's going on here, and quite frankly, most people are one or two paychecks away from being homeless themselves, whether they realize it or not. Until it happens to them, they don't really realize how big of an issue this really is. And I lived in the jungle for a little more than 10 months until I got cleared out. And I was there because I was living with my wife and an apartment, and we ended up having to move because of her health, and we tried to get a single floor apartment, and the people that we were going to rent from ended up deciding to rent to relatives, and then so we went back to our original landlord after we'd given a 30-day notice, and she said, "I'm sorry, you know, we already rented it out. I'll give you 4 more days, but that's it." So we packed our stuff, put it into storage, and we started living in a car. And we found that wherever we parked our car, somebody would come along, police or whatever, and tell us, "You can't be here. You gotta go. And so we were running around all over the place. And it was until she started suffering edema from not being able to keep her legs elevated that her doctor suggested that we get a tent and go camp somewhere. Well, KOA camps are too far away, and she's gainfully employed for 40 hours a week, and so she needed a place to be able to lay down. So we got a tent at the jungle. And we knew some people that were already living there, so it was kind of easy for us to do that. But we were victims of that particular situation. I had been homeless. I've been off and on for 15 years. I've been homeless. I had a business here in Silicon Valley, and I had my own home. I had a family different from this wife. I had children, and when the manufacturers decided to move out of the country, my business dried up, and I ended up losing just tons of money. You can't imagine how much money I'd lost, and I was unable to get another job doing the kind of thing that I was doing, and I was an engineer and trying to get back into that kind of work, and there just was no work available. I was offered a job in China, but I've been there, and I don't want to go back. Not a good place to be. So I ended up being homeless at that time, and I ended up losing not only my house and my business. I lost my wife and my kids. I lost everything. And I was living in a car at that time for quite some time, and I ended up finding people that would let me sleep on their couch. I started, again, different types of homelessness that people don't even think about. And at the time I was doing this, I wasn't really thinking that I was homeless, but looking back on that, I realized, yeah, I was homeless then too. I did not have a home. So what this all comes back to is the fact that most people don't realize what homelessness is. When you see that guy standing on the corner begging for money and you kind of don't want to look at him, you turn away, you're not really giving him the dignity that person deserves, male or female. You're not showing them any kind of dignity whatsoever. And they're human beings. They have feelings just like everyone else, and they fall into bad times. And some of them turn to drugs, some of them turn to alcohol, some of them turn to all different things because of their condition, right? Because of the situation that they're in. And they're not necessarily bad people. And some people are drug addicts, and they were drug addicts before they came home.
Robert, let me interrupt you because this is this is a familiar story, although your unique story is of interest to me. I think there has recently been a growing concern in the country, and we had a protest yesterday in Santa Cruz about the abuses in the police departments, which can particularly impact people who are outside, homeless people, people who are sleeping rough. And I'm just wondering, has there been much response in San Jose to the rising awareness of institutional police abuse, violence, and lack of accountability across the nation, as shown by the Ferguson, you know, the murder of Michael Brown, the murder of Eric Garner, and numerous other people, you know.
Yeah.
Is any of that, I mean, San Jose, I've been looking at older stories. There were organizations that were fighting for police accountability 20 years ago that I was in contact with, a guy called Juan Haro in those days. But is there any rise in awareness of that either among the homeless population or among other people you know? Do you see more possibility of at least people standing up and demanding changes around police abuse?
Well, it's first of all, very hard to organize the homeless into a group of people that are actually going to stand up for themselves. It's something we're trying to do right now. But the fact that the police target homeless people is a fact, and I myself was also targeted. My wife and I were coming home from the movies, and we have a car, so we drive into our tent area. We have a little driveway. We park in there, and the police officer comes up, and he shines his light on us. He says, "Get back in your car," and I had no idea who it was, and I saw lights, but, you know, we see lights from trucks that come down the street all the time, so I didn't know what was going on. Anyway, long story short, he ends up holding me in his the back of his vehicle, handcuffed, for 2 hours while he figures out who I am and, you know, what's going on, and he finally turns me loose, right? And he's telling me that I can't be there because I'm trespassing. And I said, "Well, I have permission to be here." And he says, "No, you don't." I said, "Yes. I have a notice here saying that I'm going to get evicted on December 4th. I said, "So the implication is that between now and then, I do have permission to be here. Because if I didn't have permission, I would be gone already." So I got the police officer's name and number, and, you know, so I will pursue something myself. But when you try to get a bunch of people that are constantly...
I'm not suggesting that is something necessarily you should do or that is an easy thing to do. I'm familiar with that in terms of stuff that's happened, you know, when we've tried to organize here over in... You know, in Santa Cruz, and I actually live in a, you know, rented room, and I've been homeless for decades myself, so I don't have that problem. You have to also deal with, you know, your own situation. I'm just wondering if other groups in town, have you been hearing about there being more protests around this? Have you been seeing any changes in attitude? I don't expect that the homeless people who are busy trying to find a place to sleep at night are necessarily going to be into a lot of organizing around, you know, police accountability. But I'm wondering, what have you got any sense of San Jose generally?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, just recently a police officer got in some serious trouble. I think he even got fired because he was tweeting about this very same thing, the Ferguson, and he was talking about, "Well, if anybody comes into my house, you know, I'm going to kill them. You know, I've got my gun, and, you know, and if you want to discuss this, I'm going to be on the corner of such and such a place, and I will be in plain clothes, off duty, and packing. I'll be packing my gun." And you know, people were outraged by that. I mean, in the light of everything that's going on with Ferguson, how can somebody, I mean, this is unconscionable. I don't see how anybody could think about doing something like that. And, you know, it would be like right after 9/11, you said, "Well, you know what, I'm going to go take out another building, you know, try to stop me." You know, it's completely insensitive to what's going on. I just don't understand that.
Robert, what form did the outrage take? Have you seen a police acting any differently toward homeless people? Like, it sounds like they aren't. They cleared the jungle, and that happened after Ferguson, and right around the time of the Garner murder, or the Garner verdict, the verdict against, you know, exonerating the police officer involved.
Right. And no, I haven't seen any change at all. I have not. I've not seen any change in the attitude of the police department either. And, you know, when you ask them about it, they say, "Well, we're just doing our job."
What about the attitudes of people? Because the police department's not going to change by itself. They have an interest in keeping things the way they are. I mean, they have power, they have privileges, they have fairly good salaries, they're well armored. You know, that's... You know, I mean, I'm not saying it's the most wonderful job in the world. I've never been a police officer. I can't really speak from any kind of experience. But as I continue to say on this radio show, from what I've read, it is not the most dangerous job, in spite of their propaganda to the contrary. It is actually one of the less dangerous jobs if you compare it with people like truck drivers and mine workers and even field workers, agricultural workers, are much more dangerous in those kinds of occupations. So I'm just wondering about the community. Do you see a growing sense that the community is likely to act? Now, the form the community acts in could be a number of ways. It can be peaceful marches. It can be riots. It can be letters to the editor. It can be, I don't know, it can be forms of protest that we haven't even seen before. People in different countries have, of course, started using a homeless approach, camping out in front of buildings, as you know, in different countries, and making changes. Some people have burned themselves, set themselves on fire. That started the Tunisian Arab Spring. So I'm just wondering, what indications do you see, if any, of this is happening in San Jose? I'm not saying there are any indications. San Jose has never impressed me as being a very hopeful place there. But
no, not very radical at all. As a matter of fact, it's quite the bedroom community, and everybody just kind of kicks themselves, which is part of the problem, because people don't get involved. And there are some groups of people that do protest, and there was a protest that happened here in San Jose over Ferguson, but it was completely overshadowed by what was going on in other cities where it was, you know, 60,000 people that showed up as opposed to, you know, two dozen.
How's your Food Not Bombs there? Have you got one?
Yeah, there is a Food Not Bombs. As a matter of fact, I get all the mailings from all different types of I personally get involved in all this stuff, and I try to get other people involved in it as well, but I don't know that people get tired of me talking about all these different issues, because I'm always trying to stay on top of things.
Do you have a pirate radio station in town? Or I know there used to be, I think, one in San Jose.
Yeah, no, I don't. And you know what? I don't even have a radio, to be honest with you. I don't have a television either. So
you wouldn't know if there were one.
Right.
What do you want people in Santa Cruz to be most aware of? What kind of message you want to put out? And by the way, you should feel free to call my show at any time with updates, whether, you know, at this time period now, 6 to 8, and I don't know how much trouble you had trying to call in. I hope you didn't have too much trouble.
Well, no, it's a little late, but it wasn't bad.
And, or in the morning, 9:30 to 1, you can call on Sundays. Please do call in at any time. I'm running out of time here. That's why I'm kind of hustling to the end of the show. But what would you like to say to conclude with?
Okay, first of all, let me give out my phone number for anybody that wants to call me directly. And I'm not such a popular person that I don't take calls. So my phone number is area code 915-471-8674. And anyone
Repeat that again.
It's area code 915-471-8674.
Okay.
And anybody can call anytime. We never close. And I will direct people to places where they can help, things that they can do. I've got a community of people, probably about 30 people right now, that I'm keeping going with different types of donations and things like that. We feed them on a regular basis. We provide them with water. We take them to their medical and different appointments that they have. We do a lot of things for them. We're trying to keep them. But the purpose for that is to build leadership, to build a community of people that can advocate for themselves, and they can go and represent themselves before, you know, whatever form of government they need to. As a matter of fact, last Tuesday, we took a number of them with us to the city council, where the city was trying to take $2.6 million to put into transportation funds out of the affordable housing budget, and we actually stopped that from happening just by telling them about how many people that were there that had vouchers but could not get a place to live because of the low availability of rental housing.
That's really amazing. You should call back on Sunday and talk more about that. I'm curious how, because you have a much larger and less responsive city. I don't know if it's less responsive, but it's a larger city council. Maybe it's, you have a larger urban area. I've been arrested in San Jose for protests with the Community Homeless Alliance Ministry. And I remember Scott Wagers and Sari Pandy. Long time ago. Yeah, it was 15 years ago or something. But I don't know that we ever stopped any. I guess Wagers was able to. We have, you know, he had a pretty good organization slowing stuff, but were they very successful? And let's talk about this on Sunday, if you can call back. Talk about we didn't talk about this, the actions against the jungle recently and your new plans. You don't have to go into it now, and how, you know, what's coming up next for you and the people you know in San Jose, and how people can be of assistance and, you know, be aware of when they can come over and help if they actually want to come over, or what they can do from a position here, but probably no time to talk about it now.
Okay, all right, I'll do that. I'll call you back and we can talk about that.
9:30 to 1 on Sunday, we'll pick up the whole conversation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We're talking with Robert Aguirre of
Homeless, which is a acronym for, don't tell me, homeless organizations motivating and expressing legal equality or for social status?
For our social status.
For
right.
Our social status. Thank you very much.
All right.
All right, man. Call back.
Okay, will do. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Yeah, that's about it for Bathurst Spears Broadsides. Coming up on Sunday, we got a lot of stuff, not to mention this callback, hopefully, from Robert Aguirre. There's going to be a call-in from Sacramento, people arrested at city council for speaking out there. Food Now Bombs being driven out of city council. There's going to be an interview with Paul Cook, who's an activist who's going to encourage Santa Cruz homeless and how to use small claims court claims. We're going to be talking also, and I'm going to play a little bit about this now, a reminder from a year ago of when Officer Hernandez reportedly pulled a gun on a family at the Salvation Army, just several blocks away from our secret location here.